There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus. Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical look at our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel. I'm your host. Drew Tirico, our producer, is at the controls. On today's program, the myth and reality of virtual reality. Drew talks to Dave Zielinski. He's a virtual reality specialist from Duke University and a graduate of the University of Illinois. And we catch up in a long list of headline news about our media environment. So do stay tuned. With Media Geek Headline News, we try to bring you stories about our media environment that often get relegated to the back pages of the business section of newspapers and often aren't covered at all in our electronic media. We think stories about media reform, about media regulation, and about media companies are not just important to investors and stockholders, but important to people worried about the media's role in a democracy. The Federal Communications Commission held an open meeting on February 10th. Making an important and much-awaited decision on digital TV must-carry. In a 4-1 decision, the FCC voted not to impose multi-channel must-carry on cable TV systems. This means that although a broadcast digital TV signal may contain several different channels of programming, a cable system will only be required to carry one channel from each broadcaster. In making the decision, the commission acknowledged that the guiding statutes were vague, but ultimately, the majority of commissioners determined that existing law does not provide a basis to require cable operators to carry multiple channels from a single digital TV broadcaster. The lone dissenting commissioner was Republican Kevin Martin, who is believed to be a strong candidate to replace Michael Powell as chair of the FCC. In his press statement on the decision, Martin writes, quote, "Ultimately, the commission made a policy judgment that the benefits of this programming were outweighed by the burden on cable operators. I disagree. I think the public would benefit from more free programming." End quote. Both Democratic commissioners expressed concerns about the decision in their own separate statements, even though both voted for the decision. In his statement, Democrat Jonathan Adelstein emphasized broadcasters' public service obligations, which he believes need to be taken into account if they are to enjoy multi-channel carriage on cable systems. Adelstein wrote, quote, "Unfortunately, without some baseline public interest obligations, I cannot conclude that every broadcaster will treat extra digital program streams with a sense of responsibility for local service," end quote. This decision was a subject of intense lobbying and comment filing by both the cable and broadcast industries. By all accounts, if multi-channel must-carry had been approved by the FCC, it would have been a profitable windfall for broadcast stations, effectively giving them two or more advertising revenue-generating channels with little additional cost. With the FCC's denial of must-carry, the cable industry has saved the cost of adding additional channel capacity for local stations. Broadcasters have vowed to challenge the FCC's ruling in court.
And in other FCC news, a budget of $304 million has been proposed for the agency in President Bush's new budget. According to the commission, the new budget will cover mandatory increases for salaries and benefits and inflationary increases for office space rental, supplies, printing, postage, and contractual services. The budget level also includes funds to allow the FCC to consolidate and upgrade commission-owned facilities at Columbia, Maryland, and to provide for critical enhancements to the FCC's major electronic filing systems. The fiscal year 2006 budget proposal represents a 4% increase over the previous year's budget. The Bush administration expects 98% of the FCC's total budget to come from regulatory fees. The administration would like some of that money to come from a yearly lease fee charged to TV broadcasters who do not give up their analog spectrum space and transition to digital broadcasting on time.
While the FCC gained some in the president's proposed 2006 budget, public broadcasting stands to take a $92 million hit. Eliminated from public TV would be $10 million already appropriated for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in 2006. Also eliminated would be $82 million the CPB was to make available to local stations for building digital infrastructure.
On February 8th, the FCC and low-power FM broadcasters celebrated the fifth anniversary of the service at a public forum held at the Commission in Washington, D.C. On the same day, three senators introduced a bill that would restore low-power FM to the levels that the FCC initially authorized back in 2000. Senator John McCain, a Republican from Arizona, and Democratic Senators Maria Cantwell of Washington and Patrick Leahy of Vermont intend the Local Community Radio Act of 2005 to allow hundreds of new low-power community radio stations to go on the air. In 2000, following relentless lobbying by the National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio, Congress passed legislation that required low-power FM stations to adhere to the same spacing requirements on the dial as full-power stations operating at as much as 1,000 times the power. The broadcast lobby claimed that the new 100-watt community stations could cause interference with 10,000-watt stations if they were spaced closer together on the dial. Community radio activists charged the broadcast industry with taking action to tremendously reduce the number of low-power stations in order to protect itself from competition, especially since established commercial and non-commercial broadcasters are barred from obtaining low-power FM licenses. The following year, McCain introduced the Low-Power Radio Act of 2001, which would have permitted more low-power stations to hit the air while requiring the FCC to intercede when low-power FM stations were causing interference to full-power stations. That bill was never passed. In 2003, the FCC released an independent study by the MITRE Corporation, which affirmed the Commission's conclusion that low-power stations pose no significant interference threat to full-power stations. That independent study had been required by the same 2000 legislation, which placed severe limits on low-power FM. For its part, the National Association of Broadcasters surprised nobody by releasing an open letter to Congress urging them not to ease low-power FM restrictions.
More than 1 year after Janet Jackson's memorable Super Bowl halftime performance, the anti-indecency crusade continues to roll on. The House Commerce Committee on February 9 voted 46-2 to pass a bill to toughen indecency enforcement. That compares to the 49-1 by which a similar bill passed the committee last session. That bill did not make it to the president's desk. The two no votes on the new bill were Janice Schakowsky, a Democrat from Illinois, the lone no vote last time, and one switch, Democrat Henry Waxman of California. The bill ups maximum fines from $32,500 to $500,000 for stations and from $11,000 to $500,000 for performers and increases the speed and oversight of the FCC indecency enforcement progress, threatens station licenses for violations, and encourages broadcasters to reinstate a family hour and voluntary code of conduct. Although the bill did not address the effect of broadcast industry consolidation on content or deal with violence or cable and satellite, several members said it should have and that the committee should use the current bill as a springboard to those issues.
And finally, the FCC just released figures on the total number of broadcast stations in the U.S. as of December 2004. There is a total of 13,525 radio stations, of which 2,533 are classified as non-commercial educational stations. There are 1,748 TV stations, 382 of which are educational. There are also 3,890 FM translator stations in the U.S. Translator stations are low-power stations that may only rebroadcast the signal of a full-power station. Commercial translators may only be used to fill in gaps of its parent station's normal coverage area. However, non-commercial translators may be used to rebroadcast its parent signal anywhere in the U.S., no matter how far away it is from its parent station. Many translator stations are used to help public and community radio stations reach neighboring communities with a clearer signal, especially in mountainous regions. However, non-commercial translator stations also have been used to build large networks of non-commercial religious low-power stations across the country. The largest of these is the Calvary Satellite Network from Twin Falls, Idaho, which operates 358 low-power translator stations. What's interesting about translator stations is that they are permitted to be squeezed onto the dial closer to full-power stations than the non-commercial low-power FM stations are, even though they operate at comparable power levels. Translator powerhouses like Calvary have been fighting low-power FM because they're afraid that local non-commercial radio stations will take away valuable spectrum space from their satellite-fed translator networks. The 3,890 FM translator stations in the U.S. greatly exceeds the number of low-power FM community stations and also currently takes up spots on the dial that could be filled by locally programmed low-power stations.
Well, thank you, Drew. And that's a bit of what's going on in our media environment. You're listening to Media Geek, a weekly look at our media environment, a critical look, really, in addition to looking at grassroots and independent media. And check us out online, www.mediageek.org. If you have any comments about the program, send them along to me, Paul, at mediageek.org. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about virtual reality. Do stay tuned.
This is a public service announcement. Sponsored by Just Blaze and the good folks at Rockefeller Records.
Fellow Americans, it is with the utmost pride and sincerity that I present this recording as a living testament and recollection of history in the making during our generation.
Allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Ho. H to the O-V. I used to move snowflakes by the O-Z. I guess even back then you can call me CEO of the R-O-C. Ho. Fresh out the frying pan into the fire. I be the music biz number one supplier. Fly it in a piece of paper bearing my name. Got the hottest chick in the game wearing my chain. That's right, Ho. Not D-O-C, but similar to them letters. No one could do it better. I check cheddar like a food inspector. My homie Strick told me, dude, finish your breakfast. So that's what I'ma do. Take you back to the dude with the Lexus. Fast forward the jewels and the necklace. Woo! Let me tell you dudes what I do to protect this. Shoot at you actors like movie directors.
Show me yours, I'm gonna show you mine.
Say the movie, dog.
Now before I finish, let me just say,
well, it's a good thing this is radio, so no one has to see what we can show.
Indeed. And that was a production by by a friend of ours, John Anderson of DIYmedia.net. And it's one of the many internet sort of floating around collages of combining Jay-Z with various artists. This was a combination of Jay-Z, his Black Album, an a cappella version with one of Ween's songs called The Homo Rainbow.
There you go. Heard only on Media Geek.
That's right.
I think at this point. Though soon showing up on a radio station near you.
Yeah, look for it on a playlist on your local Saga or AAA station.
That's right. So, Drew, you got a chance to speak to Dave Zielinski.
I did.
Who's a friend of yours.
Yes, he is.
But also engaged in some interesting virtual reality research and action.
Yeah, that's right. I you know, this is somewhat off the beaten path of our usual stuff that we cover here, but I thought it was sort of an interesting look into this technology that sort of disappeared off the pop culture map. You know, it used to be somewhat of a hot item that, you know, discussing what virtual reality was going to be in everybody's home, and, you know, it was this very, you know, sci-fi craze, kind of like, you know, computers were going to be doing our dishes for us.
About maybe 10 years ago, it seems like. That was a big buzzword and a lot of talk, and people would wear these big honking, like, kind of look like the old people sunglasses they put over their glasses. Only, you know, that would immerse you in virtual reality. And there were movies, actually, you know, probably about that time and maybe even going back a little bit earlier, talking about virtual reality. And you're right. It's one of those things that you really don't think about. But it hasn't seemed to be very prevalent in pop culture recently, and people having virtual sex or, you know, playing virtual golf or doing many other virtual activities.
Well, Dave goes into some of that with us. He kind of talks about what's going on in the industry currently. I know he actually studied it here at the University of Illinois, and he's working there at Duke University on it. And he's going to tell us a little bit about some of the modern-day applications, about those headsets that we, you know, everybody knows and loves. Unfortunately, they haven't changed much, and he talks about why. So here is Dave Zielinski on virtual reality. Thanks for being with us here on Media Geek. So you are a virtual reality programmer. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into virtual reality?
Well, I did my undergrad and my graduate studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. My original career idea was to do something with video games.
Do you think a lot of people get into virtual reality that way? Do you think most of your colleagues sort of got into it from having a large background in video games?
That's kind of interesting. I'm going to have to say no on this.
Yeah.
People get into any career for a lot of different reasons, especially something that's as mixed media as virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people get into it just from coming from all their science backgrounds, signal processing, biology, information visualization.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the field of information visualization? I'm sort of vaguely aware of it, but maybe our listeners aren't.
Well, I guess within virtual reality, you have a lot of, just as it's a mixed media in its presentation, people use various sound systems, whether it be headphones or multi-channel speaker setups. For visuals, you use either head-mounted displays, which people are familiar with as the goggles, or what's actually more used throughout the industry is the cave system.
And what's
which,
that?
I always lovingly refer to it as the ghetto holodeck. Basically a 10 by 10 by 10 foot room, and you rear project onto all of the screens at twice the normal frame rate, so you're interleaving a left eye and right eye. And you sync that up to some shutter glasses, and then you get a separate image for your left eye and your right eye. Actually, the 3D vision effect is one of the flagships of current virtual reality simulation.
Well, what do you mean by flagship?
I mean, the thing that would separate a virtual reality experience from just a desktop experience. So that's the first part of it, is just the media presentation of it, you know. Each of those can fall into a traditional media, you know. There's been sound for a long time. There has been 3D vision for a certain amount of time if you look at the red-blue stereo mode used in, you know, some gimmicky movies.
Right.
But the key thing that makes virtual reality different from those mediums is that you employ sensing technologies. It's pretty open-ended, but the bare minimum, at least as in the standard for most systems, is head tracking and hand tracking. But the key thing here is you have very tight measurement on the user's positioning.
So one of the main parts, also the main functions of virtual reality, is this sort of feedback mechanism, right? So you've got
the
user feedback. Usually it's a stereo visual display, but not always, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be. But it is sort of key that you have some sort of user feedback, be it from, you know, something as simple as a mouse or the equivalent of a mouse in 3D space or more advanced interactive devices. What other kind of interactive devices are there out there?
Well, once you go beyond just the standard head and hand tracking, the sky's really the limit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People have gotten into trying to use high amounts of sensors to get all the joint information in the human body. You can get any kind of biological data back, usually like heart rate, breathing rate, body temperature, perspiration on the skin.
What type of applications is, you know, this modern virtual reality, all these modern virtual reality feedback mechanisms used for?
It's a pretty large field of possibilities. Like I was talking about earlier about information visualization, you get into some already existing fields, namely scientific visualization and information visualization. One of the hottest topics, at least as in terms of medicine, is trying to understand protein-protein interactions and DNA into protein folding, which is a very complicated three-dimensional geometric process.
So it's visualizing these sort of molecular interactions used for medical biology. What else? What other kind of applications would you get?
Well, another thing you can do is you can look at the area of information visualization, and this is something that's be thought of as in data mining, which is taking large volumes of data, and how do you extrapolate patterns from that?
So why don't we shift gears a little bit and talk about virtual reality as sort of a medium in itself, as part of one of the media that we consume. Sort of, this is a very specialized medium. I realize it's not a TV, it's not a radio, but It's been popularized in a lot of sci-fi literature as sort of being, you know, the next TV is going to be your interactive virtual reality internet headset thing. I mean, what do you think about that idea, given your studies?
I think it's kind of interesting because a lot of things are not as popular that are interactive. I mean, certainly the internet's popular, and certainly video games are popular, and certain media like music and movies, they're all very passive consumption activities. It's kind of interesting to think about something like in Brave New World, the idea of the feelies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I am. I think probably our listeners are too, but they're these, they're sort of the movies that, you know, give you a feel experience and have give you smells and things like that. It's basically like an enhanced
It's basically
movie.
All of the sensory ideas that they're trying to put into virtual reality, but without the interaction. So that's one thing to say, but at the same time, you get games now, what is it, EverQuest?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where there is tens of thousands of people logged into the server, and in a certain sense, virtual reality is just another level of technology that could be built onto the similar idea.
Well, what do you think a barricade to that is then? I mean,
well, I think at this point there's some technological problems and some cost issues. No one's really made the headsets or the case systems that are cheap enough, portable enough, and high fidelity enough for the regular user to tolerate.
Since it is such a very pricey medium, you know, it's a very specialized visualization for professional applications typically. I mean, you mentioned medical applications that this is used for. What kind of other applications will fund this kind of equipment in any kind of setting?
Well, I mean, I've already talked about the medical stuff, so in that case, you have things like the NIH.
What is the NIH?
National Institute of Health. In that sense, you know, you're very much into the either a scientific visualization or in the cognitive psychology experiment realm. So I've heard of the automotive industry.
So it has some sort of industrial manufacturing applications.
Well, anything where the prototyping costs are so expensive that if you spend a little bit more money on virtual reality, in this case using the technology as a mock-up of something you're going to eventually create, I guess it's pretty cost-effective.
Right. Well, if you have a very large budget, right, it's pretty cost-effective.
Well, that's the other thing. Another industry that I'm sure you're interested in is the oil companies.
Mm-hmm.
Do a large number of virtual reality investments.
So what do the oil companies use virtual reality for?
They have lots of seismic data, lots of geographic data to pick where they're going to drop their next $1 million well. And once again, if you're going to invest millions of dollars in this thing, it doesn't hurt to put some money into examining the data in 3D.
I see. They use virtual reality to investigate sort of the topography of where they're going to be drilling to find oil.
Yes.
So who goes hand in hand with the oil industry that uses virtual reality?
Well, I mean, you do have the various government military institutions that are also very much into virtual reality.
I see. They use it for sort of these combat simulation roles. So we've got the oil industry, the military industry, and the medical industries. These are probably, are these the three big ones?
I'd say so.
Okay. Well, how do you think virtual reality would become sort of a consumer medium in the same way that television or radio or the internet have? I mean, what would that take?
Well, I think one of the key problems you have with virtual reality right now is it's always encumbering, whether it involves some goggles you put on or a large room you step into, and I think that definitely limits it. But at the same time, there's a lot of interesting work going on with auto stereo displays.
What's that? What's an auto stereo display?
Basically, it gives you a 3D pop-out effect when you're just looking at the monitor. I'm not really up on the physics of how it works, but, I mean, you very well might see this in storefront advertising, kind of a hologram effect.
I see.
No, I think very well the video game industry might be the first to push it onto people.
And they've sort of tried with with mixed success in the past with some different products. Like Nintendo had a virtual reality thing that came out more than 10 years ago, and other people have made the head displays that produce a 3D vision thing that you can just hook up to your computer, but by and large they're expensive and clunky and delicate.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is one of the problems, is that nothing's really driving the head-mounted display market right now to get any better. So far, every company that's manufactured virtual reality hardware has gone out of business.
For the consumer market, you're saying?
Yeah, especially for the consumer market.
So this is because you have the industry that's, the money that's driving this is not coming from a consumer base. It's coming from an institutional research setting, which by and large gets its grant from the medical industry, the defense industry, and the oil industry. So where is virtual reality going to go, at least as far as the public eye is concerned, in the public sphere? Is virtual reality, do you think, is it going to fall off the map as sort of this hot topic, or do you think it's always just going to be lingering where it is?
I think we already saw the initial kind of bursting of expectations back in the mid-90s. So I wouldn't say there's any danger of a big drop-off. That's already happened. The term has already been revealed to the public, and then people realized that there's just not the technology in place to make it a viable experience for the average person. But I think the key question you have to ask, is there going to be a killer app for it that ever elevates it to that status of being in every home, the same way that maybe, email or surfing the web pushed computers out from being at large businesses and universities into the everyday person's home? That, I don't know about.
Well, Dave, I'd like to thank you very much for being with us on Media Geek. We'd like to have you back again sometime after you've gone to the conference and can give us more of an update about what's going on in the technology sector. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And we need to get Dave back here virtually, I think.
Yeah, right.
In the studio. None of this cell phone stuff.
Virtual reality conference.
Virtual Dave Zielinski. And he is a virtual reality programmer at Duke University and a graduate of the University of Illinois, where he learned virtual reality programming, talking a bit about the myths and reality of virtual reality. But here, we are quite real, coming at you from the studios here of WEFT. And of course, we'll be coming to you again next week with more news of our media environment. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.